Harambe, Harambe, Harambe.
Working together for progress.
Feel the oneness of Harambe.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
Alassia, Harambe listeners, Harambe Radio, you are live at the 9 o'clock hour, which is for the Liberator Zone, with your host, Baye Kemet. And I have as my guest tonight, Mama Makini. And we are going to talk a little bit about the history of her participation in the African Center school movement. But before I bring my guest on, I want to make a few announcements just to update the community on some of the things that are happening. This weekend in Trenton, we're going to have our Man Up Hood training. It's actually manhood, but it's also man up. So at the same time, it's Man Up Hood training. It is going to be this Saturday and Sunday for boys 7 to 13, and it's a weekend event. It's an opportunity for some brothers, some men here in the city to get together with themselves and also spend some time with some young brothers in the community. We're going to do some canoeing with them. We're going fishing. We're going to have some workshops. We're going to do some team building activities. We're going to have some African drum. And just a good weekend to spend with you know, some black men and some young black boys. So please, if you can, contact me. You can, you know, hit me at the Garvey School at AOL, T-H-E, Garvey School at AOL. Also, you can go on our website, www.thegarveyschool.org. At the same time, the Garvey School is in the process. The Garvey School, Egun Omode Shule, we're in the process of purchasing a building, a liberated space that we can call our own, and we are asking for your continued support. So we ask that you visit us again at our website at www.thegarveyschool.org, and you can make a donation right on our website. I want to, again, give a big shout-out to the Council of Independent Black Institutions, my guest last week, Baba Sanyika Anwije, and also to Baba Kofi Lomote, who is recovering from knee surgery in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And our regards and our positive energy goes out to you and your family down there in Louisiana. And without any further delay, I want to welcome my guest on tonight, Mama Makini. Are you there?
I'm here.
All right, Ashe. All right, I want to thank you for coming on tonight.
Well, you're quite welcome, and thank you for having me. Scientist Mama, for having me.
Yes, a key too. Well, for more reasons than one, I wanted to have you on the show tonight. But more importantly, I wanted to have you on to represent African complementarity, or represent the balance that we should have and need to have within our institutions and within our community and all the things that we do. I mean, more times than not, especially when we're dealing with brothers, is a lot of times we have activities where it's, you know, heavily led by men, but all of the work is being done by women, and sometimes the women are in the background and they don't get in the forefront, or they don't have a voice. And so I recall when we were planning the CB conference last year, actually participating in it, that was one of the things you said to me, that we need to have some women on the panel. And so I always remember that, and just in that spirit, we have you on tonight. So so I want to, you know, I want to begin, Mama Makini, please, and, you know, you can take your time. We have the whole 4 hour. I want you to, if you can, just start off and let, you know, the listeners know who you are. Let them know, I guess, you know, some background information, you know, about you, where you grew up, and just basically talk about how you came into the African Center School Movement and your participation in it.
Okay, that's not usually something that I like to do, and just talk about myself, but I'll do a little bit of that this evening. I'm Mama Makini Niliwambieni, and my participation in the African-Centered Education Movement probably began much earlier than I'd like to think it did, and that is just primarily due to my family's participation in, or at least acknowledgement of, who we are as a people in the way that they acknowledged it. I grew up around the Crisis magazine, Ebony the Jet, as many of us did, and not, of course, realizing the impact that that would have on me at a later date. I was actually born and raised in Trenton and discovered of late, how about that, and discovered of late that my family has been in New Jersey since the early 1800s. We were able to obtain some paperwork of manumission papers, actually, of a distant, of a relative, and we're not completely sure, but we're pretty sure that that is probably our introduction to New Jersey from the South, so the early 1800s as freed Africans, which may also speak to why we were, again, through the African Methodist Episcopal Church, involved in our education as a people. But then more contemporarily, I became involved in the African-centered education movement through the African People's Action Movement, which was the organization that founded the African People's Action School, and APAS, as we called it, joined CB, the Council of Independent Black Institutions, and opened our doors back in 1976. At the time, three of my five children, well, actually at the time we opened, I think only a few of my, was that 1974, I think, but no, 1976. Three of my five children were of age to, four of my five children could attend the school at that time. And so they did, and my eldest daughter was still very much involved peripherally. But we started at the African People's Action School with three students, one of whom was one of my sons. And,
you said three students?
We started the African People's Action School, yes, with three students, and they were our children. That is, the founders' children were the first students, and shortly thereafter, two or three other students joined us. And so our goal, of course, was to ensure that our children had a culturally sound, balanced education that was rooted in our history and rooted in the goals of our people, and that is, of course, to work towards our freedom, our liberation at that time. We worked heavily also on what we could do here with various liberation movements that were happening or continuing to happen on the continent at that time. So that's my earliest involvement in African-centered education. And it just seemed, as we got involved in it, it really seemed to be the thing that not only we needed, but of course our children needed, our people needed to uplift ourselves. And of course, we weren't the first ones. As we got into studying about who we were and who we are in our history, we find that we've always had this ebb and flow of organizations that focus primarily on our African-centeredness. And so it was as though the spirit of those who had started before us, we found in ourselves, and we needed to and had to continue to process. And I think my introduction was through a Kwanzaa program in 1971. So I usually let folks know that I celebrated Kwanzaa since 1971, very close to its origin. And Kwanzaa kind of pulled us in.
In Trenton,
yes. Trenton had, I would say, its first Kwanzaa program out there on North Clinton. On North Clinton. Now, the place is no longer there, and I can't tell you that I can remember the name of it. But it was the North Clinton Community Center. Maybe it was NAM, North Greg Sims' organization that
you
was
know,
somehow
I went to
involved.
NAM. I went to NAM. NAM is the name. I went to NAM.
Okay.
It used to be on Taylor Street. The building is actually still there, if it's the same building.
On Taylor Street.
On Taylor Street. Yeah.
Well, Well, I know there was a garage in the back of something on North Clinton where we had all kinds of activities.
Okay.
And I think I remember the first Kwanzaa program being there. And I really didn't go there to celebrate Kwanzaa. I went there to participate in the program, but that was the beginning of my Kwanzaa celebration, and have continued to do so since.
Oh, watch that. All right. So in some of the earlier days of, you know, you being here in Trenton and doing work in African People's Action School, what are some of the highlights that you remember? I mean, of course, I'm pretty much, you know, there's a lot of things you can think of, but what are some of the things that, you know, pretty much are cornerstone memories for you at that time?
Well, I don't know if this is a positive or a negative, but I'll say it. One of the ways in which we trained ourselves to open a school was to visit schools that were already in existence. And we visited one of the first CB schools, and that was G2 Wayusi School in New York at the East.
Right.
And we were challenged by him. I think we came away from there away from Brooklyn feeling as though, well, we have to do this because we were just told that it would never work in Trenton. So, you know, I clearly remember that challenge and remembering us feeling as though probably a little put out and probably more than anything saying definitely now that we've been challenged to do so, we're really going to make this thing work. So I clearly remember that. But another thing that I remember is visiting or attending one of the hearings of Assata Shakur. She was tried because Trenton is the capital of New Jersey, and she was tried in federal court
right.
there on at Perry Street. And so we marched our little children around the corner. They were definitely preschoolers. And sat in the courtroom. Now, I can't remember any of the proceedings. I recall simply recall her turning around and looking at us and smiling or giving us some kind of signal that she acknowledged our presence. And I don't know if our children remember that, but I remember that clearly. I remember also that the African People's Action Movement, as well as the school, were involved in quite a number of organizing movements, organizing the community. One that stands out is the tennis organization, which got started in Miller Homes.
Okay.
But, you know, all of this was a part of us educating ourselves, the community, extending ourselves to the community, as well as making certain that our children were grounded again, in African history and in our education. I recall clearly that we had very, very little. You know, we were young and all of that youthful energy. You know, you can work 14 hours, 14, 20 hours a day and never seem to tire.
Right.
And always seem to, certainly we had our children with us all of the time, those of us who were the founding teachers. Well, the founding teachers and those of us who joined. I was actually not a founding teacher. I was a founding member and joined the teaching staff after a couple of years of our, maybe a year or so after we opened.
Okay. And who was if you can recall, who were the founding teachers?
I'm sorry?
Were they the initial teachers? Is that what you mean by founding teachers? The teachers who were the first ones?
Yes, the first teachers were also members of the African People's Action Movement. And they were Mama Kweli and Mama Hashima.
Okay. I see. And so, you know, because it's interesting hearing your story, because, of course, I've heard many stories through Makita, my wife, through, you know, Mama Pat, Mama Dino, and just, you know, all the people over the time, you know, over the years, even Baba Shuja, you know, I've talked to him about some of the early years. But I think that I haven't quite got my finger on Mama Afia.
Okay.
Which one lived in Trenton?
Well, Mama Fia hails from Trenton also.
Right, Mama Fia, right.
You're saying Mama Fia, who is the current director of the preschool in Nation House, correct? Is that what you're asking about?
Exactly. How you and her were drawn to D.C. is the question I want to know.
How were we? Okay. Well, Mama Fia was a parent, and she volunteered and worked at the African People's Action School, and she and I became very close. And then she had an opportunity to come to D.C., and I had already been down to Washington, D.C. for one of the teacher training institutes through CV. And when she had the opportunity to come to D.C., we certainly were very sorry to lose her her participation at the African People's Action School. But we called the head, called Nation House, and said, you know, one of our teachers who's very, very talented is coming to D.C. Would you, you know, we hope that you can accommodate her, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how she ended up in D.C., just through an opportunity to come down and connections, you know, that that African grapevine still works.
That's right. And so you pretty much followed in the same vein, or were there some other external reason that you left Trenton and moved to D.C.?
Well, I left Trenton. I remained in Trenton until my youngest child completed the African People's Action School. And I was really having difficulty enrolling another child in the public school system.
Okay.
My older children actually weren't doing badly there, and part of the reason, I think, was because my family tried to have an impact wherever they were. You know, the schools recognized that they were involved in African dance, and we did performances at public schools in Trenton and in Ewing. But the schools had begun to deteriorate, and on a personal note, I just felt that, and it, you know, it's not me. I say I felt, but obviously there was a spirit that was guiding me to move to Washington, D.C., having a friend here that I visited over the years, several occasions. My children were, every summer, they were eager, not initially eager, but eventually eager participants in an encampment that happened in Virginia that Nation House sponsored. So I was drawn to Washington, D.C., and decided that my children knew about Nation House. I mean, remember that CB had annual science fairs, and the African People's Action School participated in the science fairs as well as did all the schools in the area. So we would all get together. I've been to Nation House on several occasions for science fairs. And, you know, we always had a great time. It was just always a place that I felt very at home. So when it came time for me to say, okay, my youngest child is leaving the African People's Action School, my child who had graduated before her, I really didn't enjoy the experience that she was having in public school, and so it became a no-brainer. I just, in order to, for me to save my children and continue them in an African-centered educational institution, I moved to Washington.
All right.
And when I moved here, I actually went on staff at Nation House for the first several years here.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. So you became a teacher there. And so in Trenton, let's go back to Trenton before we get to Washington, D.C. Before, you know, I guess, so I'm assuming North Trenton, your children were going to Junior One or some other middle school in the city?
They were scheduled to go there.
Okay.
I actually had to do some make some changes, and they went to Ewing schools. And I think this is important because I was under the assumption that Ewing schools would be better because they were better on an academic side, I thought they were at any rate. But what I discovered was that, and this may not be the case for every child, but what I discovered was the cultural grounding was much more important than the initial picture or sense that, well, the academics are in place. And, you know, the school was not, I felt at the time that the system, based on what my experiences had been, was not exactly friendly towards African-centered families or African children, period. And I think that, too, is what made unsettled my spirit and made me look elsewhere, made me look to, you know, possibility of moving completely out of the area and refocusing on African-centered education for at least my youngest three. My oldest two, one was in college when I moved, and the other was a senior in high school. So I, of course, didn't move them.
You know, I appreciate your comment. Actually, I was having a discussion with a brother earlier today, and my answer to him was pretty much very similar to what you were saying. In fact, I put up one of my posts on my as my status today on Facebook earlier, was that something to the effect of, like, African-centered education is the only way to educate black children. Anything less is uncivilized. And I just threw that out there just to see what kind of responses I would get. And a few people responded, you know, but one guy kind of went back and forth with me. He was a friend of mine. I think he was really kind of, you know, trying to tear jerk, but I think, you know, at the same time, he was kind of serious. His position was that, and many people's position are, is that, their position is that, you know, academics is paramount to character and culture. They think as though that as long as the children, science, language arts, social studies, you know, arithmetic, all the basic, you know, core curriculum content things, that's the end all, the be all to education. And so we went back and forth, and I was talking to him about how, you know, education is about the, you know, total development of human character. And that if, for example, if America understands that one of the main issues that we have in our community, the black community, is, let's just say, the destruction of the family, fathers are absent, mothers, what have you, then school should primarily be about how to reconstruct the black family. You know, how can little boys become better fathers and better husbands and better brothers, and how can girls become better mothers, and, you know, so forth and so on. And so, you know, if our schools are not going to be designed to help our people out of the situation they're in, then the education is not conducive for our children. So we went back and forth on that. But, again, I'm just trying to, like, add on to your position, and I appreciate your comment, that, you know, we have to look at these institutions for our children and begin to measure them up, not only what their academics has to offer, but what the school culture has to offer. You understand what I'm saying, Mama McKean?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm in one sense, I'm very fortunate at the age that I am. I was able to stride. Had one foot in one age and one foot in the other age in terms of our development and movement. And so my family, I say that to say that my parents, my aunts and uncles talked all the time about Lincoln School. I missed Lincoln School because Brown versus Board of Education happened in 1954, and I went to a segregated school in my kindergarten year of 1954. And I don't remember it much, but I definitely remember the next school year, which was 1955, and I had moved with my aunt who had integrated a neighborhood, and I was one of few in an elementary school in Trenton, in Jefferson School, which I understand was just being rebuilt. And I remember their stories of being in a segregated school, and it felt so much like home. And to me, that was the culture, embracing our children as our children embraced it. It was a reciprocal thing. It was, as my aunt often told me, remembering Mr. Hill, who was the principal of the school. But Mr. Hill went to the same church as her family. Right. She always said that anyone in the school could discipline you from the custodian on up to the principal.
Right.
Every, and it's just, and how I still marvel at how my mother knows families of African people in Trenton. She can tell you who married who and whose sister was who, and we all went to school together. She knows so much about everybody, and that's because of the schools being segregated and everyone having to be in a place, but them feeling, aside from their encounters outside of their school and their communities, but feeling very safe and feeling very protected and very nurtured. And
right.
These were very bright people who had a purpose for their education in their faith all of the time. You did not fail because you knew. If you failed your entire family and your entire community. You were that close. And I think African-centered education offers our children, even though now it's on a more global perspective, but it offers our children that safe, that same sense of safety and protectedness and nurturing and care. My youngest daughter and her friends often commented when they were in school here at Nation House that it didn't feel like school. It felt more like a community center.
Right.
And if you stop and think about, well, what does the community center offer and how does it feel, then you say, okay, oh, wow, because they didn't want to go home. Of course, they were children. They didn't want to get up and come to school in the morning. They didn't want to go home either.
Right.
So there's that sense, and we see that that continues in many of our schools that are truly African-centered. You are taught by people who feel very much like an extension of your parents. There's a way that we talk to each other. There's a way that our expectations are communicated from adults to children. There's also a sense of responsibility that children have and take on in their school, in this place that they're educated in. And again, that also depends upon those people who are operating the school and how we decide to operate it. What is the style, how the environment, how we
right.
set the school up to so that our children will in fact feel that way. So it was, in a sense, it was easy when I look back at the stories I heard from my mother, and who is the youngest of her siblings. So I got a chance to hear her siblings who had been in the system even longer,
right.
in the segregated system even longer. And then I can see it even now, the relationships that they developed then and continue to have, you know, 50 years later. I still go among them and still see the relationships that they have with the same people. I remember from being at 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. It's amazing,
right.
and it's doable, and it's what what I think we need in order to sustain our communities, and
right.
actually to rebuild our communities and our families. And it's, you know, we think that, well, school is just where you go and learn your ABCs, your 1, 2, 3s, not necessarily how to be a family person, as you said, to be a father, to be a mother.
Right.
But in an African-centered community, we have to do it a little differently based on where we are and how it is that we came here. I don't think we can forget that.
Right.
I don't think we can forget that. As a matter of fact, I'm working with a group of students and training in peer mediation right now, and we happen to see an article in today's paper in the Washington Post. It was very, very interesting. It featured a group of students sitting in front of a gentleman who was still remembering the Holocaust and talking with them about, I haven't finished reading the article yet, but his experience in the Holocaust, and, you know, the children were all very attentive, and they were all African or Latino.
Right.
And I wanted to make a point to the students who are being trained in peer mediation that in this particular unit we're doing understanding other people's points of view, that culturally we have a point of view that differs from everyone else's point of view. However, we think that it's important to remember and learn everyone else's history, and we don't want to know our own, which impacts how we see things, how we exist, how we think, how we walk, talk, how we do everything.
Right.
And in African-centered education, as one of these young folks said, I'm really glad that I'm here in this school, which happens to have been the KEMA, the Comedic Institute for Magnificent Achievers, here in D.C., you know, who utilized the Comedic philosophical principles. That he still said, I'm really glad that I'm here getting getting taught this way, because it was mm-hmm. different when I was in public school. So even, you know, the children, always, their spirits are so pure, and they connect and they recognize in an environment that allows them to express themselves, that they are feeling more nurtured, and, you know, being nurtured in an honest perspective when they're learning about themselves. And, you know, we've learned over the years to teach from a perspective of love, from a perspective of knowing who we are, without necessarily having to degrade anyone else.
Right.
As we're telling the truth, so be it. You know, I mean, if your experience with us in history was less than wonderful, well, I'm sorry, we have to teach that, but it's important to teach our children the truth.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, there's so many things you touched on I want to talk about, but I'll make this comment, then I'll get to my next point. You know, you said that we teach from a perspective of love, you know, and I think that that's one of the things that really separates our African-centered institutions, independent schools, from many other schools, that when we come in, we see the young man that's sitting in front of us or the young girl sitting in front of us as our child, you know, and we're teaching them. We understand that we're teaching them because, you know, we are about building the entire nation collectively, so that the way that we're teaching them, that person needs to go out and be able to replicate, or not necessarily replicate, but be able to demonstrate this information, or this, you know, this knowledge base, so that they can come back and, you know, take care of our communities when we're long gone. I think that's very different from a public school, charter school mentality in terms of teachers. Not saying all public school or charter school teachers. That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about the mentality that is being taught to those teachers, or the energy that is fostered in the schools, is that we're here to teach a curriculum for either a test or for a particular purpose. But it's not to mobilize our students in order to empower themselves to become, you know, keepers of powers in the world. It's not for that purpose. And we're quite challenged often in an African-centered setting, having to explain that to people, that we are teaching our children that it is their rightful place to be empowered, you know, and to be at the same table, if not at the same table, ruling the table with all other ethnicities or cultures or people around the world, and they don't teach that in a public setting. So I just wanted to, you know, add on or give our shade to what you were saying. And then I'm going to bring it to my next point. I've, again, did not witness the origins of this, but I have seen it now as I'm older and on another setting. But I've heard the stories about you as a parent and forcing, I would say it very nicely on the radio, forcing your young children, especially Diallo, and he's even talked about it, to drum. And for those who do not know, your children and many others are the members of Farafina Khan, which is a African dance and drum collective ensemble. And I would say ensemble because it's not just African dance and drum. They sing. They do all kinds of other cultural activities that are still connected to the spirit of African-centered education. When you see Farafina Khan, you see the effects of African People's Action School, Nation House, CD Institutions, the Science Expo. You can see all of that in one of their performances. So I want you to talk a little bit about, as a parent, what it was like, you know, I guess in the early ages, or what you saw as a parent you know, wanting to groom your children, not necessarily to found Farafina Khan, but to be where they are today as a parent.
Wow. Yeah, of course. And actually, it was, I guess it was Mahiri Ndiallo that had to be made to do what they now make a living doing. And most people probably would not believe that, but they actually share that when they're talking to young people. We actually started on that path through the Children's Theater Company, which was a part of the African People's Action School, and that the Children's Theater Company got started with us helping someone who became a friend of the school. She was not a parent there, but she became a friend of the school. We attempted to help her finish an art project at Trenton, at the then Trenton State College. And her art project was to make puppets. And so she wanted to do something, well, she actually had to demonstrate the puppets in order to get a grade. And so our students, and I'm sure my children were involved in that. This is going back, like, whoa, 80, 79, 80, 81. They were involved in her demonstration. And from there we thought, gee, why not have, you know, our children do like a puppet show, a puppet theater, and make it theater by children for children. We did a performance in Newark, New Jersey, I believe a friend of mine who asked us to come there. Something was going on at the Museum of African History or Art in Newark. We performed there, and when we got there, we found out about, or I saw a flyer about West African dance classes and started attending. Because some of what we were doing in our theater group was drumming and dancing, and we had no idea. You know, the spirit was there, but we didn't have the proper technique or anything else. But so we basically conjured up the spirit of the thing and was sent in the right direction. And from there, we began to travel back and forth to Newark and New York to learn how to drum and dance West African style.
Okay.
And it just kind of evolved. That was a thing that sustained us while we were in Trenton. The Children's Theater Company performed all over New Jersey, all over Trenton, New Jersey, at various schools, junior high, elementary, high school. We performed at colleges in outside of Trenton. We performed, as I said, all over New Jersey, community colleges, colleges. And when I left Mamadino, your mother-in-law continued and even and developed, as certainly she should have, the Children's Theater Company. And we came here and teamed up with Nation House, who were already having classes, dance and acting, West African dance and drum classes, and just continued it from there. Definitely, their African-centered education is evident in Farafina Khan's performances and their just their development today. And as a matter of fact, they are developing or have developed the Farafina Khan Youth Ensemble. And we recently went to Michigan and a couple in Charlottesville, Virginia, and did some performances. So the intergenerational performance, the intergenerational, let me say, call is happening. And it's happening very rapidly. I'm not even sure where any of us are really ready for it. So just sharing our culture through drum, through dance, through theater, and teaching is has now become a part of what they do in Farafina Khan. Mahiri is actually the founder of Farafina Khan and the artistic director. Diallo is the managing director. And Nakinji is one of the dancers.
That's
so in terms of, you know, my children's participation and performance in Fadafina Khan, which of course means the sound of Africa. And one of their goals is to pull us together. During the years of prior to Fadafina Khan, we had several experiences that demonstrated the need for Africans, no matter where we are from, to recognize that Africa is our foundation and that we're all there. We may be coming from different parts, from different sides, and having different expressions, but they are all African, and they all come from this one place, because there is this pull that we were seeing at dance conferences and dance classes, and we actually had to remind folks that you know, only the water, that we are connected by the water, and so a sub-theme to Fadafina Khan is that only the water separates us.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an attempt to show how we are the same rather than how we are different. So in several of the pieces that they have developed, it will include, we brought in drum set, the various drum, different drum styles to come together and perform. The reggae is involved, just various and sundry expressions of our music. So that's one of the attempts and one of the goals of Fadafina Khan. And I think it's working. It's a lot of work they're seeing, but it's working nicely. And what's important is that their children have taken this on. And one of the members of Fadafina Khan walked into the dance class recently and heard some drumming going on from the basement and asked, are the boys downstairs drumming? And we said, yes. I said, yeah, they just finished, you know, drumming for the warm-up, and now they're downstairs drumming. And he laughed and said, wow, you had to force us to drum. Now you have to force them to stop.
Yeah.
If parents would simply not buy into this greater society's idea of children have rights and, you know, gee, they're people too. I'm not saying they're not people. But sometimes we have to, you know, introduce things that we know they need to do, what we sense or feel that they need to do, instead we just say, well, you know, as our parents in my generation certainly told us, if you didn't go to church, you didn't do anything else on Sunday.
Right.
You couldn't pull out your roller skates. You couldn't go to the movies. You couldn't go visit a friend or have company. First things first.
Nothing else.
And so, so the first thing that we have to do is to, you know, tell our children you need to get your homework done first, or you need to do this activity, but you're going to be busy. You're not going to be idle. You're going to do what I, as a parent and the authority, say you're going to do first, and then we'll talk about perhaps the things that you want to do. But, you know, we're afraid or something. To do that with our children, because maybe they won't like us anymore. But that's not, shouldn't be our concern. You know, we're not trying to be our children's friend. Otherwise, they may have to experience too many different challenges in their lives before we get them back, if we get them back.
Right. You know, of course, we all know that that's a mentality that we adopted from television and adopted from Europeans about, you know, being and, you know, allowing them to choose, have free reign of choice to what they want to do in life and what they want to be. And again, you know, without any thought to what the community needs or what our family needs or what the nation needs, we allow our children to choose. And more times than not, I've seen it on my own self, you know, coming up with friends through the 80s and the 90s. There were kids in my community that was actually much more brighter than me. And they were in what, quote-unquote, gifted and talented class and all of these other kind of things. But when you look at it, I mean, a lot of them are just pretty much have day jobs or criminal records or so forth and so on because, and that means a lot of reasons. I'm not going to pinpoint it to one, but for the most part, a lot of their parents allowed them to choose whether or not they wanted to go to college or whether or not they wanted to, you know, do X, Y, and Z. I mean, I remember when I went to Clark Atlanta, there was this guy, it was funny, I read about him maybe a few months before I went to college. He was in Chet Magazine. His name was Booker T. Washington III. And, and he had actually gotten a scholarship to Clark Atlanta. And I remember talking to him, and he was like, dude, he had no choice but to go to Clark because his father went to Clark, his grandfather went to Clark, his great-grandfather went to Clark College. So there was nothing he can do about it. And I was like, you know, and I always appreciated that. There was a lot of people in the South like that that were second and third and fourth generation college grads. And was a lot of us from the North who were first generation students going to college. And I always appreciated that about people from the South. So their parents are making them not only go to college, but go to the college of our alma mater. They have no choice.
And we don't hear about that. We don't, you know, we tend to we tend to think that, you know, we are the first, those of us who were born and raised here in the North often tend to think differently of our brothers and sisters in the South. And
right.
That's, again, that attempt to segregate us instead of integrating. But we have to take on the responsibility of pulling ourselves back together and knowing,
right.
You know, what really is going on and how important it is to remain attached to our family. I think the family dysfunction has happened a lot quicker in the city with all of the various distractions that we have within
mm-hmm.
the city life and also the fact that we're not connected to the earth here in the city as we are in the South. So that there was an attempt to, or a need or better ability to keep traditions going.
Right.
And we've forgotten about the importance of tradition.
I agree. You're most certainly right. You know, so I just wanted to say that I got a phone call yesterday from Diallo. I thought it was quite interesting. In the middle of the day, I get a phone call from Diallo. I pick up the phone. I'm like, peace, bro. And it's this automated response that he sent out to everybody for them to watch his group that was on MTV last night. And Diallo and I talk quite frequently, but I mentioned Diallo because when I was at the Sankofa conference in April, you know, everyone was talking about the party Farrafina Khan was performing at Alma's, you know, that night and what have you. And I was already tired. I drove down to D.C. and so forth and so on. But I said, you know, I really want to see them. And I went to the club, and I'm out. It's already to 2 o'clock in the morning. So I think I left there maybe 2:30. But I told my wife, I told everybody, what I saw was an absolute. It was an event, but it was at a club though. But it was African drum bands. They had a reggae artist. They had the dancers. I mean, of course, your daughter was dancing. Your daughter was hanging too, even though she's a little bit older than the other children. You know, the other sisters of it. You know, but she was hanging. She was dancing, and I mean, it was a club atmosphere. They had a live DJ, and I said, you know, this is the type of energy that I can be, you know, and looking in documentaries and things that it seemed like Fela had when he was in Nigeria. You know, what Farrafina Khan is doing is harnessing a certain energy that the hip-hop community has and pulling them into a conscious arena that nobody in the club normally would do. They're bringing drums to the club. And I appreciated what I saw, not just from an artistic perspective, from a philosophical perspective, but the ideal of it. To bring the drum and dance into a club in a hip hop setting and force people, and they kind of mixed and mingled it. They had a hip hop DJ, he spent songs in between their sets and what have you. And then when we came back to it, they brought it back to the dance. And then at one point, they were like playing go go with the drum stuff, you know?
Yes, yes. And again, that's the attempt to show how we are similar and that we can take us. Meaning we can take our traditions of drumming and dancing anywhere. Take it with us. We don't save it for a performance because it's not exactly a performance. It's a part of who we are.
Right.
You know, it's getting together and pulling down those, bringing a message to the people no matter where we are in the way that we do what we do. And the automated message of watch MTV, Beat Your Feet Kings were on America's Best Dance Crew, and they managed to advance to next week, as a matter of fact. It's in and of itself a very interesting story because Diallo has discovered that while he's managing this group of young people, there's so much that they don't know. They're adults. They're young adults. They're not children. They're not like 14 to 16 years old.
Right.
Year old. They are 21 and over. However, based on their education and what they have not been taught, even in their families or wherever, he's really had to take on a role as big brother slash father, which I know he didn't expect initially. He expected, well, this is, you know, just the group that I'm going to end up managing, but it's the management is a lot more than managing at that level. It's really parenting slash managing. And it's interesting that my children have actually just, you know, taken this on and done it. I guess it's not interesting. It's what we do and what is expected of us when I look back at what my aunts and uncles and parents did and I did. We're happy that, you know, it's continuing in that way. And the Beecher Feet Kings, as well as the Crump Kings came to D.C., the Diallo invited them here. They had a dance contest, a dance-off, where they danced, or a battle, where the two forms battled. And all of these primarily young men, now there's a young woman in the Beecher Feet Kings, pulled together or allowed their energy to be used by the drums and allowed the drums to use their energy, and surprisingly enough, you know, realized that the movement that they can do to the drum and watching African dance movements is also similar. And that's a part of what we have to do. We have to sometimes reach our people by helping them see that what you do, what you think that you're developing or you founded or whatever, has its roots in a very, very ancient system. And it's really just basic stuff. It's basic, but what is also required of us is to give of ourselves to, yes, our families first, but sometimes we have to extend it, you know, beyond our families, and we just find ourselves in that position to do that. But I think that's all part of us building community. But we can't lose sight of our own families as we're building community.
Right.
So it has to be one and the same, you know, well, building your family and not forgetting about your family as you're building the community and not allowing the community to pull all of your energy away from your family. That's a delicate balance.
Yes, it is. You know, I think you made a very good point about, you know, your son managing the group and becoming a manager slash parent, because I mean that's essentially where we are as teachers now. I just got finished coaching flag football today, and I mean, even though the kids that I'm coaching are 5, 6, and 7, and many of their parents are there, most are women, and I'm finding that the more things that I get myself into, whether it's rec basketball or rec football or manhood training or teaching, whatever it is, you are no longer just that. You are the surrogate parent. You have to take on this added responsibility that no longer that did not exist when we were growing up. When we were growing up, your mommy, dad came out, or your mom and the aunt came out, or your mom and the grandma. It was always two people you can pretty much count on that stood up for this child. And it's not like that anymore. I'm not surprised that he's probably running around and having to get this person up and run, you know, just like raising a child. I can totally believe it.
You will encounter, if you haven't already, you know, parents, mothers who will expect more of you along the fatherhood realm, because they will be at wit's end with their sons and will count on you or call on you to assist them in some way, you know, to help their boys understand what it is that they need to be responsible for or how to do what they need to do as men would show their sons. Mahiri actually stumbled on a summer camp for boys because of that, because there were a number of his students whose fathers were not there, or some whose fathers might have been really busy, and here he was after teaching drumming in the summer's drum camp, having time to take boys around and show them how to do those manly things that only men can show boys.
Right. Right.
You know, so he found himself actually having another camp. With at one point this year, at least, I think I saw 13 to 15 boys.
Right.
And, you know, that's what we need to do. Or else we'll have our children, I think. Or else, you know, our children will be having friends of other children who will be pulling them in another way. So sometimes we just simply have to say, okay, wait a minute, these are my rules. You can come with me and you can come with us, but you have to abide
right.
by our rules. And you end up having, you know, 10 children where you thought you only had two. Sorry.
Yeah, most certainly. Most certainly.
But
you
I
know,
think that's where we are. That's what we need to do when we're talking about our children playing with children from dysfunctional families. What do? Do we chant
right.
them being drawn in and eaten up by these families and these various these television shows that really aren't teaching our children anything, or do we have to step up and be parents and give up our comfort that we want to hold on to and, you know, help our children grow in the way that many of us have? And so I think the choice is clear if we see ourselves continuing as a people.
Yes, I agree. You know, it's funny you said, I remember last year, one of the parents at the end of the football season called me and said, Ibaye, me and the boy's dad, you know, ain't getting along, and he ain't got nobody around, and I need you to come around and just, you know, say hi to him, maybe you can take him out, all that kind of stuff, you know? And I just thought to myself, whoa, like, you know, it could become very overwhelming. I mean, great kid, love to spend time with him, but of course, we have five children of our own. My wife is pregnant with our sixth. You know, that kind of thing. And so, you know, I called a couple times and went around. But then, you know, we got to be very careful sometimes. When women play games, I mean, then she's back with the guy, then she ain't with the guy. I was like, all right, you know, you get mixed up in those kind of things. But the point I'm trying to make is that whatever you do, you know, you're no longer just that. You know, our society now is pulling at us left and right. And it appears, though, in the last maybe 10 to 15 years, but most certainly the last 10 years, everybody seems to be stretched at within, you know. And I don't know, maybe we can talk about that at another time or whatever, but everybody seems to be wearing 4 or 5 hats, you know, at this time period, which makes our community.
This is a very special time period, and it's possible because it's a period of change. There are so many changes going on around us. We see environmental changes happening constantly. If we look at, on a global perspective, what's happening with government and, you know, with land masses and people, and then bring it home and look at the various changes that, you know, are happening around us, it seems as though this is a period of change. I mean, I can't tell you exactly what's happening, as some people can astrologically or, you know, with Earth and everything else. I can't necessarily do that, but, you know, you feel it, you see it, and you wonder, wow, why are all of these things happening to different people? When you just talk to people who are close to you, and it seems as though everyone is going through something different. You know, we're surrounded by change, and sometimes we just have to be still. You know how your grandparents and mine would always say, be still during a storm and listen. Just sit and be still. You don't need to do a whole lot of moving around. There's something in all of these adages that the elders in our families, had believed in and passed on to us, that we need to stop and listen, because we're constantly moving. And that's one of the things, too, that we've got to take back when it comes to educating our children. They are constantly distracted.
Right.
The cell phone, texting, the iPod, the this, the that, and the other, and our children have all of it.
Right.
And these are distractions, and we find it difficult to say, no, put it away, have a rule and mean it, and put it away. But then at the same time, you can't ignore it because they are accustomed to having all of their senses challenged and used at the same time. So then we also have to say, okay, how do I learn how to use this technology to my benefit or to their
right.
benefit? How can I use it so that I can really teach them through what is distracting them constantly?
Right.
So we can't ignore it. We have to use it and recognize that we've got to provide them with opportunities to use these things and make sure that they understand they are tools. They're not their lives, but they're tools that you use. That's another project that I'm working on, actually, for a teacher friend of mine and I are working on developing a hands-on approach to African-American history, and it's called Applied African-American History. Wherever we are, there's some history around us. Get children out of the classroom and go and see what their ancestors experienced, because they need that kind of stimulation because of all of this technology that they're using.
Right. You know, we have probably about 5 minutes left, Mama King. Actually, probably about no more than 10 minutes left. We're going over a little bit. Normally, we would end at 10, but we have a few more minutes left. And if we can you talk a little bit about the importance of using African traditions to assist our people with finding some sense of sovereignty and some sense of just plain saneness within ourselves? And I'm asking that question. It's very interesting. I'm watching a documentary on Mayor Marion Barry. It's called Nine Lives of Marion Barry.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. and it's very interesting, you know, just how our people are led to certain political or social or financial heights, but that there are so many social ills that will pull us away from where we are, and I think a lot of times is because we are far away from the shrines and the spiritual work that we used to do prior to coming, you know, here to America. So maybe not speaking directly to Mayor Barry, but I'm talking in terms of our people as a whole. How can, you know, talk about the importance of practicing an African tradition in relation to us reaching some sense of sovereignty?
Well, one of the things that we haven't talked about is the Ankobia Society, of which I'm a member here in Washington, and which developed after I moved here, and I'm one of the founding women of the Ankobia Society. So we have the dual leadership, men and women, model through Ankobia. And as Ankobia has developed over a 20-year history, we recognize that one of the basic things that we were moving away from that is tradition is understanding that we are a part of God's order, that we are not necessarily controlling it, although we are responsible for who we are and what we do. and that's a primary belief that we have definitely moved away from. And that is God's order. And in God's order, we are required to have righteous behavior at all times. So no matter what it is that we are after, if we focus on our behavior being righteous and in concert with the way nature works, we don't have to necessarily worry about distractions, although I would say in this day and age, you always have to worry about it. Just know that it's there, but keep your focus on where you're headed and what you're doing. And so if we say that God is our center, but we are afraid to, I will say, recognize that many of the beliefs that we have been tampered with by others. And even in developing and finding our traditions, we're often led by people who perhaps don't have the entire picture of who we are, or that particular belief system, or how it is that we need to practice the tradition. But the intention is positive. The intention is good. And we have to challenge ourselves and others to, you know, stop for a minute and really look into our traditions and learn them and try as much as we can to put them in place here where we find ourselves. That's not an easy task. But searching who you are, I think when you work on who you are and what is natural for you, what feels natural, what is natural because you're not, practicing something that really has self-hatred all wrapped up in it. You have no choice but to be able to do what it is that you're called to do in a more righteous way. But I think in terms of individuals, using traditions is a certain righteousness that we have to keep at our forefront.
Right.
Why are we doing this, and how should it be done, and how is it done so that, again, it's in concert with everything else around us and other people around us, and be willing to be responsible for ourselves and not have this victim mentality that a lot of us have. And, you know, you have to learn how to communicate your needs and communicate why it is perhaps you're unable to do something or what it is that you can do and not feel as though, you're going against, well, like you're a sinner or like you're feeling guilty. I mean, that does so much to our psyche that we don't even know.
Right.
I'm trying really hard not to step on anybody's toes right now.
right. Then, and if, for those of you that don't know, I mean, if you could just explain Oncopia to them, you know, just what the organization is and what have you, I think that, you know, some people may be listening and may not exactly know what the organization, you know, exactly is.
Well, the Oncopia Society is a society of families that have come together for the purpose of revitalizing, it's come together for a three-pronged purpose, and that is reafricanization, nation building, and family development. The process of reafricanizing requires that we be willing to look at our history and understand that we have been pulled off our African course, and in order to reafricanize, we have to shed some of our beliefs and some of the way we do things, probably most of the way we do things, or how we look at things, those things being of a social nature, especially but not only limited to the social nature in terms of how we relate to each other, but many other ways as well. Psychologically, there's so much that we have to shed that I'm not sure we realize because of the history of African people. No other people have experienced what we have experienced to the degree that we have experienced it.
Right.
No other people. And so to go from and to participate somewhat in our own demise, it says a lot about where we are now and why we got here, and also gives us a sense of what we have to do to know who we are so that we can become a sovereign people. A sovereign, that word sovereign is really, really important because it implies that we govern ourselves. It implies that we are willingly taking responsibility for who we are, where we are now, and where we have yet to go. And that's not what we're doing right now. We're still asking. We're still begging, please give me, give me, give me. And at some point, we've got to become a sovereign people. It's a step-by-step process, and it is a process. And we won't see it in our lifetimes, but we have to put things in place so that it happens when it's time for it to happen.
Right.
But it won't happen just happenstantially. It will happen because we are doing some of the things that we are doing now. We're putting in place, first of all, Oncopia means the vanguard, those who have never left. We are always here. Those who have always been here, and it comes from the Chi language of the Akan people of Ghana, West Africa. So many of our people who were brought here came from that area. and were even sent from that area to ensure that certain aspects of our traditions would always be continued.
Right.
And when we investigate our history and we really get to know the elders in our family and the elders in our community, we see that there are those practices that continue. Sometimes we have to look hard to see them, but those practices that can be traced back to our origin are still there. And it's just important for us to... It's so much more than important. Important is such an understatement. It's if we want to exist in a way that is healing for us,
right?
If we want to continue to exist in a way that that supports us, that helps us truly grow and develop, we have no choice but to know who we are. Or we will continue to be, or we will just be puppets, you know, wondering why it is that we seem to take 3 steps forward and 10 steps back.
That's right. I most certainly agree. And, Mama, I am not going to keep you any longer. I know we are 15 minutes past the hour. And, again,
wow.
I want, yes. I want to, that means we've been on the phone for an hour and 15 minutes.
Hey.
But it went by quickly. I told you it would go by very quickly.
It certainly did go by quickly.
Yeah. But again, any last words or any last announcements or anything that you want to let the Harambe listeners know, please let them know at this point.
Well, I thought that's what I just did, close it out. But certainly for Harambe listeners, let me invite those listeners to, I guess, check the school's website for any activities that may be happening here to support African people. We certainly invite, you know, our people to come and participate in certain activities that we're having here in Washington, D.C., but support your families and the activities, you know, in wherever you are. I think the last thing that I would like to say is to encourage all folk, people who are listening, especially young folks, to get to know your family, to find out the stories from your elders. Don't let them go without finding out what they did as youth, to find out what their parents and their grandparents did. There's so much information involved in our own specific families, and we often tend to look outside of our families, and we want to look at the, you know, the larger-than-life figures that are a part of our collective history. But we have so much history within each of our own families. I would want to encourage people to start there as we are looking for our Africanity, as we are re-Africanizing. We have to start building within our families and pulling all of our family members in and not being ashamed of or wondering if or how family will look at our African practices. If we don't force it on anyone and let it happen naturally, you'll find that over a period of time, we as those who are re-Africanizing ourselves will be asked to bring what it is that we do to family events or ask our opinions or ask various questions that let us know that our family is interested and involved and, in fact, contributing to our re-Africanization and our development.
All right. Ashe. All right. Well, Mama Makini, again, I want to thank you for coming on the show tonight. This was a wonderful show. It was a trip for me through Trenton history, you know, most certainly through African People's Action School and the stories of Trenton and Farrafina Khan and Nation House. And again, I have to have you on again at some point so we can continue the discussion. And again, I want to thank you. I will be forwarding this over to you tomorrow, so you'll have to contact Diallo so that he can put it on a CD for you.
Okay, definitely. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. I certainly have enjoyed it. I guess I like to talk, huh?
Yes, no problem, Mama. So you be safe, and we will definitely talk soon.
Okay.
All right, you talk now.
Thank you. Thank you. Asante, Simon.
Asikitu. So, yes, Harambe listeners, you are listening to the Liberated Zone live here at the 10 o'clock hour now on Harambe Radio. And for those who are listening and those who want to, call in and support Harambe Radio, you can do that at any time at 877-514-5454. And again, I am Baye Kemet. My guest tonight was Mama Makini. And you can also follow our school and the information and activities that we have to offer at www.thegarveyschool.org. And again, just some brief announcements that we are having a few events here in the city of Trenton. One this weekend, which is a manhood training for boys 7 to 13 years old. And if anyone is interested for Saturday and Sunday, you can send me an email at thegarveyschool@aol.com. That is thegarveyschool@aol.com. And for those people who are listening and who want to, align themselves with other institutions, other individuals that are in the line of independent schooling, that are in the line of not charter schools is what I'm thinking, independent schools and homeschooling, after school programs, Saturday school programs, or anything of the like, you can most certainly go on www.cibi.org, which is cb.org, and you can download an application for membership, and you can most certainly join with us on the African-centered front. So, again, Harambe listeners, I thank you for the show tonight, and we ask that you listen again next week at the 9 o'clock hour for the Liberated Zone, which with your host, Baye Kemet, and we're going to sign out at this point. Peace and blessings to Tanana.